Hello, everyone. This is Jeff Salzenstein, and I've got another very impactful interview coming your way today. I've got one of my dear friends and former coach who was the coach that was with me when I broke the top 100 for the first time at the age of 30. He's seen me through my highs and lows. He saw me the very first day when I showed up on his court, and I had no clue how to hit a low volley, among other things. And really helped me bring that passion to the game that was a bit lost on me. You know, being raised in a more traditional sense with more technical-based coaches, this coach really brought the feel and the artistry back to the game and the joy. And I owe a lot to our guest today, and we're going to talk about the forehand, which he knows a lot about. Welcome to the call, Joseph O'Dwyer.
Carl, it's great to hear your voice, one of the truly passionate former players on the tour and now absolutely embarking on an unbelievable coaching career. Anybody who's accessed your information and your materials are definitely on the fast track to improving their tennis games. Congratulations. Always great to hear from you too, by the way.
Thank you, Joseph. And for those listening, he referred to me as the seagull. Quick little background before we jump into the forehand. There is a book out there called Jonathan Livingston Seagull by Richard Bach. It's about a seagull that soars and flies, follows his own path when he's soaring in the clouds and does not follow the flock. Joseph appropriately named me the seagull when I was about 28, 29 years old as I was embarking on my journey on the tour. So if he refers to me as the seagull throughout this interview, you will know the reason why. So, Joe, we're going to talk about the forehand today, and let's get started with that concept, that feel-based concept right off the bat, because I know that's what you brought to my game, and I know that's what you bring to the junior player, who you have tremendous experience with, working with a lot of nationally ranked players, college players, you've worked with a lot of NCAA national champions, and of course, high-level ATP and WTA players. So why don't you bring that thread of teaching feel as well as visualization to all levels of the game and talk a little bit about your experiences with that.
Yeah, well, the biggest thanks, Seagull. I hope we'll be able to get through this over the phone. But yeah, probably the biggest thing that we focus on the forehand, no matter who it is giving the player the feel, and by that we talk about like really being aware of where the racket goes when it begins its journey. So there's no really set way to take the racket back, is what I'm trying to say. So when you do take the racket back, the only thing we talk about is that the racket head is above your hand when you take it back. And whatever way that goes back, it can be high like Leighton Hewitt, it can be a shortened version like James Blake, and there you have the beginning. The most important thing is that the beginning remains the same. So whatever beginning you choose to use, you go ahead and you pick the style that suits you. Biggest pitfall to avoid is the scooping. You do not want to be an ice cream scooper. In other words, when you take the racket back, letting the racket drop below your knees and then taking it up. You take it back so that the racket head is above your hand. And that's the beginning. And that's where it starts. And then the next part is the swing. And you show the player where the racket finishes. And I'm like you, I'm a huge proponent at the end that you catch the racket with your left hand so that you have a really consistent follow-through. And then, so you have the beginning and then the end. And just making sure at the very end that your hand turns. If you're right-handed, that your hand turns after you hit the ball. And you catch it, and you've got the extension that you need, and that really is the basic forehand.
And I've noticed that, you know, again, you've talked a lot about how you start, how the path of the racket feels, the awareness of it, the finish. You know, I haven't really heard you talk a lot about elbows and hips and shoulders and eyelashes and pinky toes. And, you know, I think a lot of coaches get too bogged down into individual body parts. And why don't you talk a little bit about, again, just build on that feel of talking more in metaphors, more and concepts that have to do with awareness and feel and visualization and how you get people to swing the racket naturally without getting too mechanical.
You don't mention angles of rackets and point of contact are lagging on the wrists and all that stuff. You really don't need to. That all kind of happens naturally. It's the beginning and the end that you want. So you just have the, basically you have your client, you know, have a nice ready position, and then you take the racket back using the left hand to take it back, and then there's a separation, and then you just literally have the racket, you can swing forward, and all you tell them is let your racket drop below your knees when you swing, come up, turn your hand after you hit the ball and catch it, and that's where you start. And then the next part, obviously, is the movement and the tracking. So then you have them, you toss them the ball, a simple hand feed, and you have them take four or five steps. And the only thing that you tell them to be aware of, that your feet stop, come to a complete stop, and then you step into the ball, and you actually start with the closed stance forehand. And then to get them to be really aware of that, you make them actually do a count, say 1,000, 2,000, and then you let them come out of their finish or out of their balance footwork. But the players are extremely reluctant in the beginning to do that. They run and hit the ball, and they don't stop, and the racket doesn't follow through. So you absolutely make them come to a complete standstill, and then they swing and they have the nice take back and they have the nice follow through. And you can pretend like you've got a camera and you say, hey, hold on, I want to take a photograph, and you take your fingers up and pretend, or your cell phone if it's nearby, and hold it up, pretend like you're taking a photograph. And then they get it. And it takes time, and it takes a lot of repetitions in order to accomplish that task. But it's so worth it if you do the beginning and the end of the swing correctly and with balanced footwork. Then you really have a real base, and then you can add the rest of the infrastructure can follow up once you have that base. You know, you can build right up to the top of the pyramid, or you can put I call it like putting the flying buttresses on the Notre Dame Cathedral and stuff like that. But it begins with the foundation, basically. Yeah.
I love it, Joe. And let's actually move into, let's talk a little bit, actually, let's talk about one more technical concept, for lack of a better word. And I stole this phrase from you. I probably should be sending you royalties for that. The offhand and the off arm is so important when it stretches across the body. And one wonderful analogy that you use is, especially with the little kiddies, is you talk about having lightning bolts coming out of the fingertips. And I've used that one with my kids on the court, and they just absolutely love it, you know, instead of just saying,
yeah,
you know, stretch your arm across, these analogies. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the lightning bolts. Maybe if you have other really fun analogies that you like to use on the court, that'd be great.
Yeah, the offhand is so important that it is to the side of your body. And you can use lightning bolts, or you can even use lasers and multicolored lasers, or you can have rainbows come out of there. But the main thing is the ball can't cross that hand. So when you go to swing, when you use that closed stance, when you go to swing, by your hand being still and out to the side a little bit, it gives you maximum extension, is what it does. And it creates the spatial space that you need to get maximum racket head speed when you hit the ball. That's why it's so important. But most coaches do not pay attention to that hand. It hangs there. They don't even know they have a left hand. It looks like it doesn't even exist for a lot of the beginning players, right up to the, including the players, the 4-5s and the 5-0 players. You sometimes have to go in and make that adjustment.
It is quite amazing. All, especially adults, when they want to fix their, that the offhand is such a huge. Let's move in a little bit. I know you're very passionate about studying professionals. You've been in the trenches, developed players at every level in the pro game, to challengers, the Grand Slam, including with me when I called 29 and saw me split some forehands. And maybe we can talk. It was a forehand. We can talk about that and buggy return I hit against George Bastel. But the guy, and that's Rafa Nadal a little bit buggy, but talk about his buggy, about his four things that he's doing that might be a little bit different than everybody else right now.
Yeah, he's absolutely bought into to using that buggy whip on the forehand, because it creates it's the finish where you have full extension and then the racket wraps back up around your head, and it's a buggy whip, but it's basically it's just one finish that you use that he absolutely loves to use full time on whatever ball, running, whenever he's blocked for time, whenever the ball is really high, he is a master of that buggy whip. And Pete Sampras had it as well. Rod Laver had it as well, but Pete kind of hit it. But, I mean, Rafa has just brought it to a completely new level. Gustav Kuerten used it 3 out of 5 times when he won the French Open a couple of years. When he was playing on the clay, it's really suited to using it on the very high balls as well. If you don't have that shot on the tour level, you are not going to succeed, basically. I mean, you have to have it's as important to you on that, having that buggy whip is just as important as having a slice backhand with all the variations of the slice. And then it's the same with the forehand. There's 2 or 3 different finishes on the forehand with hand turns, and then you have the buggy whip as well. And Nadal just knows when to use it and how to maximize that buggy whip better than anybody that's ever played the game, ever.
And what is he doing specifically, maybe besides the forehand, the buggy whip finish? I mean, what do you think he's doing that just makes his ball just absolutely rocket off his racket with incredible spin and drive that basically you see grown men at the highest level again game like Federer and Djokovic, you can almost feel them like backing off of the ball as they're hitting. What's going on that allows him to basically dominate these guys with his forehand?
He has complete mastery of the geometry of the tennis court. It's like looking at a PhD mathematician. He understands when to use that sharp cross-court forehand. Like if you pull him wide and you go outside of the margins and your ball happens to go near the sidelines, you give him the opportunity to really to hit it, you know, cross-court at a massive topspin that brings you off the court. It's at the service line, so you're off the court, or he'll take you line. So he's, you know, if you watch the U.S. Open final, you'll totally understand the only way that you can even, you know, hurt Nadal basically right now is if you hit that ball low trajectory through his forehand. But he's done so much work on that pattern that it's no longer a hole now. It's not there anymore. You know, Novak was not able to break it down in the final of the U.S. Open, even by doing that. He did it for periods of time, but over the 5 sets, Rafa was just, he was just too good. Forehand was too good. And he changed his serving patterns. He you know, instead of going 70% to Novak's backhand, it was 70% to the forehand. And yeah. I believe if he played Andy Murray, Murray's forehand would have been seeing the same pattern. He would have been getting a lot of balls into the forehand. Yeah. He had rare ability to understand the geometry of the court. And then also, his coaches are able to pick the weaknesses out on the whichever. They can find the weak wing on whoever they play, whether it's the forehand or backhand. They find it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take it back. Take it back to movement a little bit. We talked about technique. And you mentioned earlier that when you start players, you do like them to be in a closed stance. And for those out there listening, just to be clear, a closed stance can also be called a neutral stance where you're stepping towards the target, not necessarily stepping across your body. But talk about this different stances, the open stance, the neutral or closed stance, the running forehand, moving back and playing defense with the different stances. How do you help players, and you can break it down by juniors, rec players, and even professionals.
Totally,
how do you break down the movement?
Oh, I'll break it down in one, and I have personal trainers that are working with some of my touring pros, and they absolutely work on that. They step out. So basically, even on your forehand, when you go to hit the forehand, you step out. If you're a right-handed player, you step out open, and then you absolutely step into the ball from that base. So if you have the time, you'll come off that open stance and absolutely step into it, particularly like when the ball's in the middle of the court, like where you talk about, Siegel, where it's kind of you're in a neutral part of the court. And that evolves, of course, into if the ball is high, they load so much on it, they load on that outside leg, and then when they step forward, sometimes the movement is so strong from that back leg that you absolutely, the front foot will come off the ground and move forward, just like it does on the serve. And it kind of happens naturally for the touring pros, but they've been shown that pattern. And it's the same thing on the backhand side. On the double-handed backhand, you start off with the open stance kind of slightly forward, and then you just absolutely step in and drive it. And that's your optimal footwork if you can do it. But, everything begins with that open stance, and then you can either use the neutral stance or you stay open or you do the kick out or you do the lift and land. And, your videos can go into a lot more detail, obviously. I mean, I'm showing that because it will take your videos to show your players exactly how those footwork patterns really look, and that's what you're going to have to do. That's your job, Siegel.
That's my job. You're right.
Yeah.
And then as far as if you're coaching a rec player, let's say they're a 4-0 and they're decent level, they play league tennis. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're going to try to get them to get on their front foot and maybe square up afterwards as much as possible.
Oh, as much as possible,
and not hit off that back foot.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to go on, like, it's kind of like what you do when you do step in. I mean, if they can't really load on the outside leg, because it is kind of a complicated, it is a very complicated load, like when you start talking about going open. So, with the beginning player, basically, as long as they step in and that back foot, like what you're talking about, it drags forward a little bit. And then you can do what you talk about. You tap your toe on the end of it, so they don't turn it over too much, which is what you show in your videos. You do an unbelievable great job of doing that. And they have to be able to do that first before you even move into the other footwork patterns. I mean, they have to show you that they can absolutely get to the ball and load with their legs correctly and have the weight transfer going forward, like what you talk about in your videos, in your details.
All right. Well, that's awesome stuff, Joe. Let's actually finish it up. Let's toot my horn a little bit here and harken back to that U.S. Open qualifying match. I'm playing George Bastel, and I'm standing 2 feet inside the baseline to return his second serve, and I lashed a buggy whip forehand return to John Fitzgerald, the Davis Cup captain, said it was the hardest forehand he's ever seen. Talk about that experience as my coach watching that from the stands.
Probably, for me, some of the happiest memories are of you, Siegel, of watching you just execute the buggy whip forehand in an absolutely ultra-competitive matches like you're talking about at the French Open, at the U.S. Open, but yeah, you would hit that buggy whip and sometimes they wouldn't even be finishing the serve and the ball would be on top of them. Or you'd be doing a full-blown run, playing people like Greg Rosetsky in Indian Wells, and Greg would hit this incredible volley and you would run over there and your forehand hit a buggy whip, winner down the line. You were so far off the court, you sat in the stands, picked the newspaper up that was beside one of the spectators and started reading it. And really, it's for those moments that I coach, is to see players like you, Seagull, just executing at the highest level, hitting that buggy whip on the run, probably put more smiles on. It's why I coach, basically, is seeing players, and particularly you, yourself, who I've spent most time with on the tour, hitting that shot. It's remarkable to see. So whether it's a volley, or whether it's a forehand or a backhand or your serve, the memories you've given me over the years are priceless. The moments that you executed in, like, it's 6-all and tiebreakers. There's so many I can't even go in. That's just two I'm giving out there.
It was great stuff. I'm sure that when I come out with more buggy whip material, we'll definitely talk to you more about the concepts and those great stories. I think reading that newspaper after hitting the running forehand against Rozetsky was not the smartest move, because after that, the guy went on an absolute rampage and ended up beating me after I was up a set and a break. So had a lot of fun reading that paper, but lost some prize money and points that day.
Yeah, you did, but
I made
still,
it. I woke up the sleeping dragon.
Yeah, you woke up the sleeping dragon, yeah.
Well, Joe, it's always a pleasure to connect with you and to pick your brain on different aspects of the game. I know that we'll be doing more interviews in the future, and we got to get you on video sometime and have our subscribers see what you're all about. They would love you.
Yeah,
thanks, Joe.
All right, Seagull, have a great day. All right, I'll
thanks
talk
for your time.
To you later. All right,
see ya.
Good fun. All right, bye-bye.